It's the illustrious from high above Wyoming mainstream media. Joined by Mr. Misdemeanor himself, the Saratoga Sledgehammer. Starting your day the right way on the Independence Network. It's time for the morning show with your hosts, David Iverson and Jailbird Joey.
It's the beginning of the end of another busy broadcast week here at the Independence Network, kicking off the morning show in fine style with my good friend and co-host David Iverson here at the station. Whoa, been a rough week. Not a whole lot happening. Yeah, not a whole lot happening, but a whole lot to do. It's weird. Still enjoying that warm weather for the rest of the day, but that's going to turn here pretty soon. But we're not going to worry about the storms that are coming tomorrow. Let's talk about the storms that happened yesterday. David, happy Friday to you, bud.
Happy Friday, man. It's my favorite day of the week. You know, it kind of, you know, on Fridays when you're in the news business, you would think that it would be a light news day. And sometimes it is. You know, people are ready to be done with work, get off to their weekend, whatever it is that they're going to do. But on occasion, people in power drop news on a Friday thinking that more folks aren't going to pay attention to it. So usually my Friday is while I'm getting ready for, you know, my weekend and, you know, starting my weekend program. I'm also watching the news pretty much all day long because, again, politicians drop stuff on Friday. It's always the watch what the other hand is doing. So Fridays are an exciting day. A lot of times you don't you get some news on Friday that you wouldn't get at other times during the week. So, and we've got a busy weekend up ahead of us. So lots of stuff going on here at Cowboy State Politics headquarters.
Yes, we call it the Friday fire hose. This is another reason why I don't do national politics as much, because it just started clogging up my weekend. You got to be just stretched thin with all your PMSNBC and Blaze and Fox News watching, especially on Friday. You're right. That's a bigger issue in D.C., but they even do it here in Wyoming. So we're going to get to a couple of things that have happened. I heard you took a little trip on the bike last night and had a meeting with a few people. I don't know. What happened last night? Out there in Bighorn. I'm really sure I wasn't there.
No, I'm pretty sure you were not there. But it was a Lions Club dinner where they have a legislative update. And there was Cyrus Fratboy Western, our pal Ken Pendergraft, and Senator Dave Kinski at the Bighorn Lions Club. It's, you know, one of those things when you don't have all the details, sometimes you miss really important ones. Like, for example, I thought the dinner was going to start at 6. Really, it started at 7. And I didn't even know that it was going to be a dinner. So I walk in and, you know, my Harley jacket and sit down and everybody's dressed kind of nice. And I'm sitting there going, oh, well, I wish somebody would have told me that this was a dinner. But then I find out it starts at 7 and the meeting went until 9, which was not a big deal. But I really don't like riding the motorcycle at night. I once hit a bear on a motorcycle at night. So while I can do it, I still have flashbacks every time I'm caught out late. Now, you know, around town, it's not such a big deal because you got streetlights. But when you're way out of town and there's all sorts of deer around, and it just fries my nerves even for, you know, the short distance between Sheridan and Bighorn. But there were some interesting things that came up during the meeting. As I mentioned, frat boy Cyrus Western, Ken Pendergraft, and Dave Kinski gave their version of what happened during the legislative session. And, you know, you got three different people from not necessarily three different perspectives, but Ken is very conservative. Frat boy Cyrus Western is a redcoat, and he's not really conservative at all. And Dave Kinski, well, he's been acting more conservative as of late, and he's also in the Senate. So there's three different perspectives from, you know, about the same events. And so it was interesting to listen to what all three of them had to say. Of course, the main topics of discussion was the budget, taxes, and there was a kind of protracted discussion about House Bill 125. Even in Wyoming, you have people who are in favor of gun control. And they crop up in the strangest of places. You would think Bighorn being a really, really small town, that you wouldn't see a lot of gun control. But there again, in Bighorn, you have a lot of people that live out at the Powderhorn, one of the most exclusive golf clubs, private golf clubs in the state. And so, you know, you get people from all different walks of life. So there's a lot of different things that happened. Probably the more important one, and it's been a big campaign issue or political issue, I guess we just started the campaign, is the 988 suicide hotline. And before I tell you what happened at the meeting, Joey, let's just talk about that just for a second, because it's one of those issues that fires people up pretty fast, and I don't think that there's a lot of thought that goes into it. So first, why don't you just give me your thoughts on it?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that the government should be directly involved in mental health care. This seems to be more of a legislative issue, a campaign issue, and a funding issue, when what it really is a social and medical issue. You know, the legislators aren't running the hotline. They're not developing the programming and the protocol for how the hotline works. It's just a, hey, this is something that I can make my opponent look bad, I can look good on, and nobody has really justified where the direct involvement of government is legitimate in any of this. My next big problem is it has always been sold to us, and this hotline and suicide prevention is not a new thing in Wyoming. I think we can go back 6 or 7 years when it was originally pitched. It was supposed to be $750,000 would fund this thing forever. And that was years and years and years ago. And then it turned into it'll not cost us a dime, which was the most recent one when they voted, I believe it was last year during the supplemental budget. And then magically this year, in order to keep it solvent, we need $40 million. I think they got away with five. My big problem is 10. Okay. I know there was some JCC2 conversations back and forth. They didn't get the $40 million, but the bottom line is when they finally ended up getting that money, a couple weeks later, open up the news saying, oh, well, yeah, now we have a semi-funded trust fund, but we're good. We didn't need the money anyway. So you have to look at it on, you know, different layers of the onion, expanding government, spending taxpayer dollars, and then should the government even be involved in mental health care? And in all three cases, my initial answer to it is no, especially because there's no way to prove that we're actually helping it. We're making a few people maybe feel better, and it may not even be the people calling in. It may just be the people working there or want to put that feather in their cap of, I started the 988 hotline. But this whole concept that the government is there to do things like this, or that it's even effective, is way beyond me. And another place where we could have had, I don't know how many, 13 special sessions fully funded off of what we gave the 988 hotline that was never supposed to cost us a dime in the first place. It just, it grinds my gears.
Oh, mine too. And you're right. It is one of those things that just makes people feel good. And in Wyoming, we have a tendency of creating programs and funding things just because it feels good. A good example of that that is in every Wyoming community is the recycling center. Okay, recycling, most of the stuff you take to the recycling center, and I know this because I was on the board of the dump in Johnson County for a long time. Most of the time when you take stuff to the recycling center, a lot of it ends up in the landfill anyway. And there is virtually no way to make money recycling. So it's a losing proposition. It always costs taxpayers a lot of money. And really, the cost benefit on it, you might be better off just putting all that stuff in the landfill anyway, because that's where it's going to end up most likely. The 988 hotline, I'm not saying it's garbage, but I'm saying that there are similar problems with it. First of all, there's no way to prove that you're actually doing a good job. I mean, if your hotline is successful, well, then people don't kill themselves. But the only way that you know if it's not successful is if people start killing themselves. But really, in either case, you're not going to know. And that is one of the big arguments against this whole trust fund that they created is, first of all, it's another government program. And like you said, Joey, we're pretty sure the government need not be in the healthcare business. I think we learned our lesson with Obamacare on that. But secondly, if it is necessary, it could be funded by private sources, and I think that it absolutely must be. The reason I bring that up is during the supplemental budget, there was an attempt to fund this thing with a trust fund. And I've got a soundbite here for you of Cyrus Fratboy Western talking about the trust fund, and I'll play it for you in just a second. But redcoats love trust funds because it takes the accountability out of the equation. If you have a trust fund that's, you know, funding some part of your government, then it just operates on autopilot and there's no oversight. So that agency, whatever it may be, doesn't have to come to the legislature every year and make their case for a budget item. So during the special session, the debate was either A, do we create a trust fund, or B, do we fund it through the budget? Conservatives won that argument and said, no, we're not going to fund it through a trust fund, though they did create one, they just didn't put any money in it. That was the setup for this session. So we have a trust fund with no money in it, and then in the budget session, they dump cash in it. So that's eventually what happened. But during the budget or the supplemental budget session or the general session, however you want to put that, it was funded through the budget. And so the idea being you got to come to the legislature and justify the money that you're spending and prove to us that you're doing a good job. Well, now it's funded with a $10 million trust fund and it is on autopilot. So let me go ahead and play you what Cyrus said last night. And then we'll talk about it.
The other one, of course, is the suicide hotline number. So you heard my colleague talk about how, you know, what was up for discussion was funding the trust fund, right? Because, as Senator Kinski said, we go through these budget cycles, right? The boom, the bust, and of course, the budget cuts that come with it. If you create a trust fund that generates revenue for this suicide hotline to use every single year, it kind of insulates it from those potential cuts. You know, seems like you guys would like to believe that this would have been out of legislative purview and that this is something that the legislature were just kind of relinquishing control of. And that's just not true. Nothing is outside the purview of the legislature. Even if we want to amend the Constitution, obviously we have to go through that process and have it go to the ballot. But everything else, though, is completely within our purview. Every legislative session, the legislature has the right, through the power of legislation, the process we have, to address any kind of situation and any kind of spending. So that was the idea behind the trust fund. The people who voted no in the trust fund, unfortunately, were the exact same people who voted no to make it part of the agency's standard budget request, too.
All right, so very first thing, that last part is an absolute falsehood. It is not true what Cyrus said right there at the end, that the folks that voted against the trust fund also voted against including it in the budget. In fact, that's absolutely what conservatives wanted to do, is that if you have to have a trust fund, let's keep it in the budget. But Joey, what do you think about what Fratboy said?
There was some misleading statements there in the middle as well, that setting up the trust fund would generate revenue for that project, which isn't untrue. There's interest that accrues. This is why they tend to do trust funds, the excuse they use anyway of, if we put so much money into it at the first get-go, we don't ever have to put money into it again because it'll be accruing interest and it'll replenish any of the expenditures for the overhead and operation. But he also said, the legislature has complete control and it is in the legislative purview, any item of business that we decide to take up, if it has to do with expenditures. Well, you just contradicted yourself in your own statement there. If the trust fund never needs to be replenished because it's gaining its own interest, then really the legislature can't address it because it's not a future appropriation. It's not something that you can deal with in the budget. In fact, you just said it was set up so you don't have to address it in future budget years. So there would have to be a specific bill to come and repeal the existence of the trust fund, and that's about all they could do. The other problem I have with what he said was, I don't know, there's so much in there, it's hard to pick them out. But yeah, it's a lot of misuse of the regulatory posture of the way they set up the trust funds. And the fact that he's using both sides within a single sentence tells you he either doesn't know what he's talking about or you know that he's lying.
Well, if you want something screwed up, just get the government involved. The conservative argument on this is not that we don't need a trust fund that we don't need a hotline, rather. A lot of conservatives think it probably is a good idea. But the government doesn't need to be involved in it. That's not one of the main functions of government. It's not the proper role of government. And for the most part, anytime you get government involved, it becomes unwieldy. It continues to grow, and it continually becomes less efficient than it would be if it were run by the private sector, which is the very reason why they set up the trust fund during the general session, so that private companies, individuals, nonprofits, whatever, could put money into the trust fund and that it could be funded with private dollars. So that's what it is. Yep. And see, what Cyrus is one of those people that believes the government has to be involved in everything, that we have to fund everything, that if the government doesn't get involved, then it's just not going to happen. Well, the truth of the matter is, if you let the free market operate on its own, and the free market is not just business, it encompasses everything. If there is a need for something will provide that need. And the suicide hotline is another one of those. I happen to think that it's a good idea, but I don't think the government needs to be involved in it. Government ought not be in the business of charity. Like Davy Crockett said, it's not your money to give. It's our money. And, you know, Cyrus is one of those that he just uses a lot of platitudes that really don't mean anything. And when it comes to budget and policy, he obfuscates and just tries to muddy the water a little bit. So it's really hard to understand what the heck he's saying.
And this is a perfect example of something you hear out of legislators' mouths a lot. Camel's nose under the tent. The supplemental budget session where they set up the trust fund but didn't fund it, that was the camel's nose under the tent, knowing, hey, we've set it up and we're going to come back and then we'll get the money next time. And normally it's a minimum of a 2-year process because of the way the biennial calendar works for legislating. But now that they're doing supplemental budgets, they know they only have to wait 8 to 11 months before they can dump the money through the camel's nose. But this is how it starts. Another example, one that kind of started grinding my gears during the legislative session, Dan Furphy and his adult hearing aid program for the, horribly impoverished. And they say, oh, it's only $90,000.
Only $90,000.
Not like we don't have any other medical assistance or low-income, medical programs out there. But for these specific people, we're going to create a position in the Department of Health, and they're going to administer it. And anybody who's 200% or more below the poverty line could get these hearing aids. Well, I wear hearing aids, so I'm definitely sensitive and understanding of the situation. I also know that when the government gets involved, it's terribly terrible. But for $90,000, you get about, plus, a full-time position, you get about 6 pair of hearing aids. So what happened with this adult hearing aid program was that camel's nose got under the tent. You will never see an appropriation for the adult hearing aid program as low as $90,000 ever again. It is now a program. It's going to be $2 to $8 million every 2 years in perpetuity because they got that started. And nobody wanted to say, old poor people don't need hearing aids, because that's what it would have turned into if you argued or voted against it. They're not looking at, the guy from the AARP is sitting right there. And I went and talked to him. I said, don't you guys have a list of hearing aid programs or free medical assistance to the elderly somewhere? And he's like, oh, no, we don't really have that list. I'm like, well, maybe before we establish a whole new branch of the Department of Health, if you care about, you know, broke old people with the AARP, you might want to, you know, get that together and say, well, we kind of got this together already. And there's state and federal programs that do this. But no, that's the camel's nose under the tent. And in the future, the reason they use that saying is because that's how the camel starts to get in. Within, you know, a very short amount of time, you have a camel in your tent.
That's exactly
right. Future money. Exact same thing. I don't think this is the last dime we've dropped into the 988 hotline. Whether it's good, bad, and different, I don't think it should exist. I'm going to lean on that. The government should not be providing direct mental health care to the people through taxpayer dollars. And this is not the end of it. You are going to see this expand, cost more, and be one of those sacred cows of, well, if you don't vote for this or continue to push, you know, to save this, then you don't care about mentally ill people. And, you know, same thing about Jeanette Ward hates school kids. This is what you're going to see it turn into in the future.
Absolutely. And I think it's worth pointing out that in Wyoming, there are over 600 coffee cans that exist for various and sundry purposes. A coffee can is what they call one of these trust funds. And there's over 600 of them. And they create them for two reasons. One, it's usually a pet project or, you know, something like the 988 hotline that, you know, conservatives think should be funded privately. The Redcoats, you know, it's their own little pet campaign project that they can say, look at me, look what I did. And the other reason they create these trust funds is to hide money for future purposes. So the classic example of this is the new prison in Rawlins. Now, if you're, Joey, you live down there, you know we don't have a new prison. But at one time, there was a coffee can with $92 million in it to build a new prison. Now, this was several years ago. You wouldn't get a new prison probably for $92 million right now. But still, that's a giant sum of money. But the legislature created a trust fund, a coffee can, slapped the $92 million in there, and then 2 years later, Steve Harshman came around, and he had another project and went out and grabbed that $92 million and used it elsewhere. And still, we do not have a new prison. In fact, we have an old prison with some cells that you got to watch for rattlesnakes in. So it's coffee cans all over the place, and this is a great example of that. Now, Cyrus also made another very dubious argument that I love this one. It's one of my favorites because it's so absurd. But it's one that liberals, redcoats, and pretty much all politicians use to convince you to do something that you know is not the government's place. But take a listen to this.
The reality is all of us know someone, a family member, a friend, neighbor, a child that we know, who took their own lives. I personally voted for that funding because I think even if it saves just one life, to me, it's worth it. It was established last summer. It's already received thousands of calls, and 98% of those calls have resulted in de-escalation. So we know it's working, and we know it's having an impact on helping Wyoming.
Okay, so there's two things in there. Let's take the first one first. Joey, if it saves just one life, it's worth it. I mean, why do you hate people? I mean, just one life, if we can save one.
Yeah, and it's funny how they use it on both sides. If it saves just one life, we should do this, or if they're against something. But it would save lives, so we can't. Repealing gun-free zones, for instance. I heard that statement a lot. You know, you're going to save lives by not letting guns just go free-floating around. Hey, it's the Constitution. The Second Amendment is the Second Amendment. The other thing the Constitution does is establish the legitimate functions of government, which doesn't include healthcare, providing the healthcare. So I hate that answer. We heard it a lot during COVID. And again, this is another situation. The Department of Health will be running the 988 hotline. They're also the group of people that went out and issued all these orders for mask mandates, shut down, backed up all of their county health officers that went ahead and usurped county commissioners and just issued order after order saying, you're going to do what we want you to do. of course, backed up by Governor Gordon. And again, know how our government structure works. The Department of Health is a branch of the executive and appointed and run by Mark Gordon. He's ultimately responsible, Governor Mark Gordon. So if you're saying that in order to save just one life, we have to expand the Department of Health, who've already shown us what they will do if they're given a blank check and a little bit of what they think is power, and it's ultimately run by Go Green Gordon, who's done all this other crap, I'm glad we have a suicide hotline, because the more I think about this, I might have to call that hotline.
Well, the argument of it just saves one life is absurd on its face. If that is true, that if we can save one life, we should just absolutely do whatever it is, why don't we outlaw bathtubs? Do you know how many people drown in a bathtub every year? What about stairs? There's a lot of people every single year that die falling down a stair, or alcohol, or tobacco, or cars. How many people are killed in traffic accidents every year? You know, it's such an absurd argument because it plays on your emotions. If it is true that if it saves one life, then we should just ban whatever it is, then all of us are not going to do anything. You're not going to walk outside. You're not going to be able to go outside in the winter because you might slip and fall. You certainly can't drive a car because you might hit somebody in a crosswalk. You can't take a bath. All of us are going to stink really bad. I mean, the list goes on and on. But it's an absurd argument that all politicians use. And the reason they use it is they're not equipped to handle, you know, defending their position. So they can't make the conservative argument against why the private sector ought to fund this 988 hotline. They fall back on the whole, well, if it saves one life, we should just do it. And again, it just plays on your emotions. It's an absurd argument. And you just, you know, write it off entirely. Now, the second part of what Cyrus said, this hotline has already received thousands of calls, and all of them have resulted in de-escalations. Okay, maybe that's true. But that doesn't mean that you're preventing suicides. It just means that you're talking to a lot of people. The fallacy being, if somebody is going to take their own life, most of the time, you don't know about it, because they've made the decision beforehand and they're not going to tell anybody about it because they're intent on taking their own life. It's a horrible situation. And if you know somebody that's depressed or that you think might be, you know, in thinking along those lines, for God's sake, say something. Go talk to them. Take them to church. Be a friend. But the reality is you can't just say that creating a hotline is preventing suicides, because there's no causal relationship there. It could very well be that you just had a lot of people that were depressed that called the hotline. Interestingly enough, also, there was a report about, I'm going to say about 10 months ago, that if you called the 988 hotline, there was an option where you could talk about being a transgender person. So there's, and again, this is the camel's nose that Joey was talking about a little bit ago. When you have a government program like this, it's easy to slip in other things, DEI, LGBTQ plus ZPD stuff into it. And, I mean, it just metastasizes into something gigantic. It's Cyrus Western, and every time he talks, I just want to scream.
Yeah, and the de-escalation and the number of calls statement also makes me wonder, where's the follow-up? How often are you calling these people back a week, a month, a year later to make sure, you know, hey, if that phone keeps ringing and they don't pick it up, do you check off? Well, yeah, they only made it 3 or 4 months. This is unprovable statistics, and I don't really believe, like you said, there's more suicidal ideology. It's almost like the new, I wouldn't say new, but the more emerging thing of, I will get more attention and increase my victim status if I appear or complain about being suicidal. And this is not really a suicide issue. This is a personal responsibility and thick skin issue. And I'm sorry if I'm going to sound callous about this, but most of the people that I've heard about that have called or had these certain issues, they don't really have suicidal issues. They have acceptance, understanding, and comfort issues. I don't know how I'm going to you know, exist in a world that doesn't see me as this special little creature, and everybody wants to be a Kardashian now, or my Facebook profile isn't getting enough likes. These are not real problems of real people, but these are the kinds of people that they talk about. So I want to see the follow-up. I want to see the research into how many of these people that you say you saved are still alive. And if a week later they're 100% better and don't need any help, there's your proof that they weren't really suicidal in the first place.
There you go. So it's a big giant red herring all the way around it. And it's a pet project for politicians, and there's no way to prove it. And it's backed up by really specious arguments. The other thing that happened last night at the Lions Club dinner was Ken, our pal Ken Pendergraft was talking to one of the members of the audience about House Bill 125. And this guy's clearly in favor of gun control. I'm not going to play you everything he said because he spoke for the better part of like 3 or 4 minutes. It's really long. And really, the only thing you need to know is he's a guy that claims to be a hunting guide, guided hunters my whole life, and we don't need guns in schools. I mean, that's basically his argument. But it's Ken's response that I wanted to play for you. I thought it was great.
I understand the vote in the legislature was almost unanimous on the guns. Am I right?
54-7 in the House.
You said 54.
What are you people thinking of?
The second.
Is the gun lobby that strong in Wyoming?
No, sir. The Second Amendment still says what it says. If you disagree with it, then you need to change the amendment. You need to change the Constitution. But as long as the Constitution, which is the bedrock of law, says what it says, then we defend it.
So what is it?
Boom. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah, and I don't know if you have the other clip where the guy actually says he's a hunting guide and people can't hit the broadside of the barn. I don't know if we're going to hear that later, but when he says, What are you thinking? What are you people doing? And Ken had a great reply of, we're defending the Constitution. But I love that it comes down to, I'm a hunting guide. People aren't accurate with firearms. Okay, first of all, you're a hunting guide. Second Amendment really doesn't have anything to do with hunting, even though you have firearms. Second of all, I'm not against outfitters and guides. I know some people that do it. I think, hey, it's great for tourism, but you got to realize the people that you're taking out there, they're probably not real avid hunters because they need a guide. And most of them probably aren't from Wyoming because they need to be guided. They don't know the area. They need to be guided through it. I believe the industry should exist. I'm not going against hunters and outfitters. I'm just saying that argument of, and again, we haven't heard the sound clip. We may not. I don't know. But the reason he's complaining is just, hey, buddy, House Bill 125 was to repeal gun-free zones. If you're a hunting guide and you're taking people through gun-free zones, what the hell are you thinking? This bill would not have affected what he originally stated his position was. I'm a hunter and an outfitter and guide people through hunting. You have to have firearms out there already. So again, it's one of those things. I don't think people really understand. They catch a complaint and a headline and they take a position real quick. And I've never been one to say, gun enthusiasts and hunters have anything to do with the Second Amendment. You'll hear that all the time from your candidates. Well, I've owned guns since I was 12. I've been hunting my whole life, and I was one of the first people in Wyoming to get a concealed carry permit. None of that has to do with the Second Amendment. None of that has to do with liberty. None of that has to do with checks and controls on the actions of government. In fact, a concealed carry permit, in my mind, is the first affront to the Second Amendment. I have the Second Amendment. Now you say I need a special permit in order to carry a weapon? Come on.
Well, last night was a good example of another thing that I think everybody should be aware of. Know who your audience is. So this is the Lions Club, and I personally think that it's an organization that does a lot of good. The Lions Club is very involved in getting eyeglasses for school children that can't afford them. They're all the time doing something for underprivileged kids in school. So absolutely a good organization. However, you have to understand the type of people that gravitate towards that sort of group. Okay, so you're very much an education person, which might lead one to believe that you might be a little bit liberal. There were several people in the audience that, and to answer your question, no, I didn't prep those sound bites from that guy. There was another good one that I missed. A guy talking about, well, I've got several guns, but not a one of them is a semi-automatic. I don't know why you need semi-automatic guns. I mean, there was a lot of that last night. So it was a, you know, kind of a liberal group. There were some conservatives in there that I had a nice conversation with. But for the most part, pretty left-leaning bunch. You know, it's not surprising that a bunch of them are going to be in favor of gun control. And that they don't understand that the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting, although hunters should be all about the Second Amendment. That's a phrase I stole from Mark Jones. But anyway, you know, just know your audience. And I think, you know, Dave Kinski is, he's the master at this sort of stuff. In fact, I have one soundbite of him. He started out, and by the way, Dave Kinski is a very skilled communicator. If you've ever watched him on the floor when he stands up and makes an argument, like with the House Bill 125 thing, when he stood up and he said, you know, this is not personal. It's nothing personal. It's just the hurly-burly of politics, the rough and tumble. You know, this is just, it's an important bill. So Dave is very adept at knowing the audience that he's speaking to. And, you know, he's been a politician for a long time. And he's a very good communicator, but this is how he started his talk, and I'll play it for you just because it's kind of funny.
Hey, every time Bill calls me, I remember I was 12 and my dad told me a joke about the Lions Club. He said a little boy's taking a biology class, and he asked the mother, "How do lions make love?" She goes, "I wouldn't know. Your dad's a Rotarian."
Okay, so kind of corny, right? But know your audience. You know, right after he said that you heard a lot of chuckles through the crowd. It kind of softened him up for what he was about to tell them, which was the legislature screwed you over with taxes. And he went on, again, knowing that that audience is kind of liberal. He gave some lip service to all the other tax bills. But he still said, look, we missed the big target, which was the 25% tax cut across the board in Wyoming. So anyway, Joey, there's your long and the short of last night. Just a couple of highlights, but, you know, some fairly juicy ones.
Well, it makes more sense now why that guy was complaining about House Bill 125. He's a hunting guide in an organization where apparently he takes 4 blind kids hunting. That's why he doesn't think anybody hit the broadside of the barn. Get those glasses fixed. Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on it. I'm interested in hearing what all the legislators have to say coming out of this session. And we've only heard from, you know, the usual suspects, people that drop op-eds and actually show up to town halls. So it'll probably be the next month or so we'll start to hear from the rest of them. And, yeah, I'd love to hear their versions of what happened because, you know, we were there. We saw it. And it's like, this is not an opinion. This is the record. That's not what happened. So, well, I'm glad you had a good time up there in Bighorn last night. And what else do we got? Let me look here. Governor Gordon dropping an op-ed. And this is going to be just a quick one. A guest golem to the cow pie. Gordon writes, Wheatland has the funding to address the failing water tank issue. And I'm not really going to get into why he says, you know, all the numbers and where the money's coming from. I don't agree with him. Otherwise, Wheatland wouldn't have such a problem with all the money being vetoed. But what is interesting in what Governor Gordon writes is, despite claims to the contrary, my line item veto of the Wheatland Water Tower project in the 2024 budget session was not punitive, but rather a reflection of the adequate support the state had already provided. Now, I would almost believe he could get away with that if he had not added that last sentence to his line item veto, directly attacking and putting the onus on the shoulders of Jeremy Harrelson's vote on the budget. What say you, David?
Well, if it is, as Governor Gordon says it is, then he wouldn't have put his snarky little comment in his veto letter, like you said. If he truly believed what he wrote in his op-ed, then we should completely discount everything he said in his veto letter, and vice versa. The governor is trying to play both sides of the fence, and he's a politician just like the rest of them. This is no different than him going to Harvard and saying global warming is a fact and we're going to be net negative, and then coming home and trying to tell all of us that he's in favor of, oh, I'm in favor of coal and oil and natural gas, even though at Harvard I said, you know, it's we're going to have to shut it off. So this is no different. You know, he issues a veto letter, and he was mad at the Freedom Caucus and at Jeremy Harrelson, and it showed in his veto letter. He struck out the funding for that Wheatland Water Tower, and he had his snarky comment in there. Well, judging how, and I don't remember the exact phraseology of it, but judging how some representatives from the area voted, I'm taking this out. Okay, so it's punitive, it's retributive, and you did it on purpose. But now you're trying to engage in some revisionist history. Oh, no, that's not what I said. This is exactly what politicians do all of the time. Now, also, and I haven't read the op-ed, I didn't know about it until you mentioned it this morning, Joey, but it would be interesting to see if there was any criticism from the cowpie fact-checking what he said. If they went back and said, well, this is what he wrote in his veto letter. This is what was said on the floor. This is why Wheatland says they don't have enough money. Was there any of that in there?
No. The only thing, well, yes and no. Not in his op-ed, but the only place you'll find anything on the Wheatland side of the argument for both the malicious intent of the last sentence and the actual water project was in an op-ed that came from Jeremy Harrelson himself. And of course, when the cowpie posts something from a member of the Freedom Caucus, there's no commentary, and actually they don't even normally put it up on their Facebook page. They'll just hide it somewhere in their website. So the only mention you'll get, I won't say there's nothing on the cowpie. There's nothing the cowpie wrote. They didn't do any journalism. Little Leo didn't get out his pen and calculator and check everything and then do his own story. It's just, here's what the governor said. Let's be good little boys and, you know, make sure we're getting our pats on the head for anything that Go Green Gordon says is important. But anyway, it's also interesting that the governor brings up the Constitution in his op-ed. The most recent budget session was non-traditional. Typically, according to the Wyoming Constitution, Wyoming's budget is intended to fund only the ordinary government expenses. In recent history, capital construction and special projects have been subject of separate bills. This year, however, the capital construction bill was defeated on introduction. That left the regular budget as the only vehicle to consider any construction. Now, I got a question for you, David. If the Constitution specifically provides, and Dave Kinski wrote a very in-depth memo on this a few years ago, capital construction is not a regular function of the government. The Constitution forbids it being in the budget. And they vote down a bill, a standalone bill for capital construction. How is the budget the only vehicle left if it's strictly prohibited by the Constitution? This is what the governor's saying. He even mentions the Constitution says we can't do this, but I didn't line item veto the capital construction, even though I recognize it's a violation of the Constitution to let it happen, and the standalone bill for it died. So the only way they could get it done was by violating the Constitution. Isn't that a violation of their oath of office, making them ineligible for office? Anybody who did vote for that budget?
Absolutely, it is.
I want to make sure I'm not totally crazy here. I know I'm a little off, but.
No, it's against the Constitution, but the only way we can do it is to violate the Constitution, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. It's the same thing that the Redcoats do all of the time. Damn the rules. You have to follow them, but we don't. And, you know, heaven help you, if you break the rules, we're going to come after you. But, you know, when it's one of our pet projects and we want to give away high schools to a couple of legislators to get them to vote for our other pork barrel spending, well, then it's entirely appropriate. Just, it's the worst kind of politics that rules for thee, not for me. I'm Governor Gordon, so I can violate the Constitution whenever I want, even though in my own op-ed, I tell you that I'm violating the Constitution. It's just, it makes you want to scream.
And that's my favorite part. When they just say, oh, we did it this way because that's one thing. When they point out the Constitution says we can't do it and here's why we did it, that's another. And that's what Governor Gordon's doing here. And if he's going to sit there and point out things the Constitution says that he can't do, let's look at Article 4, Section 10 of the Constitution, where using your veto power retributively, maliciously, or to gain a vote is also against the Constitution. And this one specifically aimed at the governor because the title of that article is bribery and coercion of or by the governor. And the last sentence, again, is it's the moneymaker. It says, yeah, whatever law or process in law currently allows people to complain, in this case, it would be a civil suit. Once you're convicted, you can no longer hold any office in the state of Wyoming. And I asked a couple legislators, I said, am I reading this right? Is this what he did in that veto and a couple of other vetoes? And some of these legislators said, yes, absolutely. It's black and white there in the Constitution. And with so many other things in Wyoming, nothing will ever come in it. You could have a well-funded group bring a civil suit against Mark Gordon for that, but that would start in district court. And who appoints all the district court judges? The governor. So it's another situation of, oh, it's absolutely a violation of the law. It's absolutely a violation of the Constitution. He should absolutely be removed from office for that, but nobody's going to allow that to go into court.
Exactly right. Well, I've got two other things, and this one is kind of a breaking news item. And we don't have breaking news on the morning program or the morning show very often. But this one, Joey, I'm telling you, we should roll out the red carpet, play the trumpets. A random act of journalism from the Cowpie. At the bottom of their article, which is entitled Fremont County Threatens Takeover of Library Board Amid Sex Books Controversy, there's a retraction. And it says, and I quote, correction, board chair Carrie Johnson did not say she had not read the two books under review, as an earlier version of the story said. Vice chair Perry Cook said that she had read Smoke, but not Tricks, citing difficulties with the e-book system. So credit where credit is due, even though they've committed so many acts of journalistic felonious behavior. We have to give it to them that they finally issued the second correction that I'm aware of in the history of the Cowpie. So, right on, credit where credit is due, Cowpie.
Baby steps. That's how you get there, baby steps. I don't know. If it took my kid that long to learn to walk, I'd just say, oh, you're a waste. But, hey, it is what it is. The interesting issue in this story that I'm remembering correctly, I hope, is that now the Fremont County commissioners want to take over operation of the library away from the library board that not only, you know, they appointed, that's their responsibility, but just a few months ago, they said, hey, you're good to go. And if I'm thinking it was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, you covered the story pretty well. They went out of their way to ensure that the library was going to be run this way. They had a director that always stood in favor of, no, we got to have all this porn in the library. And then she said she was going to resign. You had three credible candidates, and there was some inner office communication. A FOIA request turned some of this information over that they made sure to identify these three candidates as quote unquote too conservative and found a way around having to even consider them and brought the old library director back specifically so they could protect porn in the libraries. And this is, you know, that 180 flip. I don't even know from a couple months ago, let alone a couple years ago. They went out of their way as a county commission to ensure that this problem was still a problem. And now they want to deal with it. Must be election season.
Must be election season. And you're absolutely right. And I don't know exactly the time frame, but I know it was quite a while ago. And I covered this whole issue, not just Fremont County, but Campbell County, libraries across the state. There was even one real nasty book down in your neck of the woods in an elementary school. That one, we have to give kudos to whomever. Let's see, how do we put this? Not name names and still give credit where credit is due.
No. That's not what we do. We point fingers, name names, and bring evidence. That was Jerry Paxton. He was the principal of the school who became the superintendent of the district that ended up going to the county commission and ultimately spent 10 years in the legislature because he was such a good guy that did the right thing, but introduced not only porn to the library, but he touts himself, I'm the guy that introduced computers to the Wyoming school system. We had the first computer in the encampment school. Well, thanks for bringing us digital porn too there, Jerry.
So there's Jerry Paxton, but the elected official I was talking about, and we'll leave them out of this. But during my investigation, I found a real nasty book that was in the, I think it was in the encampment elementary school library. And I alerted this elected official to it. And that person assured me that that book was no longer going to be in the elementary school. So I've been covering this story for a long time. And the Fremont County Commissioners, this has been an interesting one to follow for a very long time. They've been fighting over this for, 10 months, a year. And Joe, you're absolutely right that for a long time, the county commissioners were like, no, nothing to see here. Not a problem. We have a library board. They have a process. They're taking care of business, and we're just going to let them do it. Well, now, in this article in the Cowpie, and I quote, the Fremont County Commission says it will take over the library board May 1st if the library system does not address its policies on sexually graphic literature in the teen section, book challenges, and internet filters for kids' computers. Quote, if we don't see the issues listed above addressed by the end of May, of the May Library Board meeting, we will be forced to remove the chair and place Commissioner Mike Jones on the Library Board for a few months to ensure these policies and concerns are addressed, says a strongly worded letter sent Tuesday to the Fremont County Library Board. And here's the fascinating thing about this. All five Fremont County commissioners voted in favor of sending the letter, and all five signed it. Now, as in the lead up to this story, we told you that for a long time, the Fremont County commissioners have been kind of hands off with this whole thing. Let the library board handle it the way that they're supposed to handle it. But now, because it's election season, no doubt, they're trying to appear like they're taking the bull by the horns and they're getting the porn out of the library and doing the right thing. But it's an interesting article. I suggest you go back and read it. But now that you know the backstory on it, it makes it all the more interesting.
Yeah, always fun stuff. And I will hand it to the library board there in Fremont County. At least they're only displaying porn and not creating it in their own library. Again, another problem we've had here in Carbon County. But we haven't talked about old Woody for a while, and I think I'm going to take a peek at what he's doing because, man, I know those elections for the Wyoming Press Association are coming up here in the next month or so, and I'd be really interested to see, are they going to take that guy and make him the president? That would just be par for the course for mainstream media in Wyoming.
You know, Joey, if they made old Woody the president of the Press Association, we're going to have to do a retroactive or a year in review, or I don't know, we'll come up with some fancy name for it, but we're going to have to revisit the story of Wood in the library and let people know exactly who this guy is and who the head, well, if that all happens, who the head of the Press Association actually is.
Yeah, it'll be fun times. I'm sure we'll have plenty of work coming up here in the next, 6-8 months. How long until November? So 8 months. Yeah, it'll be all sewed up and finished by then. But yeah, our big push has got to be focusing on what's going on between now and the primary, the candidates that are coming up. And we got a few minutes left. We can kind of talk about this a little. I'm going to make some speculations over what needs to happen for the Senate in order to keep this at least 50-50, if maybe not push it over the edge. First thing is Fred Baldwin is stepping out of the way. And that vacuum has the potential of being filled by Albert Summers. I'd consider that one a draw. If Albert Summers got in, it would be a little worse, but the bad votes that Fred Baldwin usually made would continue. But you could count on him about 35% of the time to do the right thing on the conservative side, Baldwin, that is. But Summers has a challenger, and I don't think it would be a bad idea to do everything in our power to focus on that race very intently, because it's a clear win for liberty, for conservatism and for Wyoming if Albert Summers does not get that seat. I have a phone number here. I'm going to call and set up an interview, and we'll introduce that challenger over on the Just Blame Joey side. She's already spoken with David Iverson. So that's one to focus on. Ed Cooper's up for re-election. I think we need to get rid of him quick. That's a pure win across the board.
You know, that one there, that's almost like anybody but Ed Cooper. But I hesitate in saying that because there's some people that could do far more damage than Ed Cooper if they were just more effective than he is. And, you know, Ed Cooper is one of those politicians that's particularly pernicious in that he hides his votes in trying to make sure critical legislation doesn't make it out of the legislature. And the best example of that is House Bill 125.
Professional bill killer. The other place I'm going to focus is, and this might come with a little controversy, but I think we need to protect Charlie Scott in his seat.
I like Comrade Scott. I really do.
Yeah, I just don't agree with him 100% of the time, but we could do a lot worse. And if you look at his opponent, that would be a lot worse. If you actually want to see good things happen conservatively in Wyoming for Wyoming, I believe keeping Charlie Scott on there. But we got a couple other races that, you know, like Dave Kinski, I consider the audience. I consider the voting demographics, the people that live in the district. Unfortunately, I think Tara Nethercott's pretty safe if she runs again. I know the area she lives. I know the people that live around there, and she is just the belle of the ball in that district. So that won't be a tough one. We do have Jared Olson trying to roll over into Affie Ellis's vacated seat. I don't know that we'll get a solid conservative candidate that's going to really be able to swing the bat there. But a lot of those are just draws. Trading out Affie Ellis for Jared Olson doesn't do anything worse. It just maintains the bad status quo in the Senate. So again, I'm going to keep an eye on the Senate side. A lot of these Senate races, Troy McKeown and Anthony Bouchard are both up for re-election. And as much as I like their voting record, I think they're vulnerable. So what we don't want to see is a big slide to the redcoat side. And really, the Senate would do well to pick up one or two more votes. And you're going to see I wouldn't say a completely different Senate, but more of the Senate you've seen, which a lot of people seem to appreciate, except for liberals, redcoats, and legislators, that action. There's also a big uproar in the potential future leadership of the Senate right now. Larry Hicks traditionally would be in line to take over as president of the Senate. Then Dave Kinski moving up into the majority floor leader role. He's already vice president. And then they're talking about possibly Sherry Steinmetz as the new vice president of the Senate. And that would be the traditional ascension, which I don't always believe in, but the, you know, traditions and genteel nature of the Senate, we've done it this way forever. There's already conversations about how the people that try to defend the way the Senate has always run are now ready to step out and vote against that, their, you know, posture, because of the individuals that are up in line next. So I'm going to be keeping a close eye on that. I think we would do well to have Larry Hicks, Dave Kinski, and Sherry Steinmetz running the Senate. And I think it's going to take a saving or flipping two of those seats towards the conservative side in order to get that done. So that's where my work's going to be for the next few months.
The House is pretty much more of the same. The conservatives need safely seven seats, keep everything they've got, and then flip seven more. That would put them in the clear majority. There's a number of races that we need to keep our eye on. Some of them you wouldn't think of. So like Bill Henderson in that's District 41. He's got Gary Brown running against him. Played an interview with Gary Brown. I think that was Wednesday on the program. Actually, it was really good. I really appreciated a lot of what Gary had to say. So I think that's one to watch. Another race that, I don't know. I mean, there's the Albert Summers seat down there, and there's at least one good conservative that's running for that. There's a couple of open seats. So Jared Olson, Jared lives kind of in a sort of red coat district, although I think it's flippable. Let's see here. Whom else? There's a lot of them. The long and the short of it is, you just need to do your research. If you have any incumbent that's that you don't like their voting record, you need to make sure that you know it by heart, that you can challenge them on it. Let me give you an example. Barry Crago in House District 40. Everybody knows that I can't stand Barry, and he's got a good opponent, Mark Jones, running against him. But that one's going to take everybody getting out and really advocating for Jones. So lots of stuff to keep your eyeballs on in this year's election. And looks like that'll about do it for today's program. Joey, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah. Ready to run into the weekend. Remember, your vote is your voice for your future. So keep that in mind and stay tuned in to the Independence Network. And we'll see you again on Monday here on the morning show for the Independence Network. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week.